elections and early voting, and DeSantis's political future. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're coming up on some very important elections next week, but why are there so few people showing up to vote early? Also,
he's cognizant of the fact that Florida has moved in a red direction pretty starkly, but it's not Ohio and it's not Iowa.
Some believe Governor DeSantis needs to win Florida in 22 if he stands a chance to run for the White House in 24. And are the Miami Dolphins about to make a controversial move to try to start winning? And finally,
the supernatural world may not be as far as you think. In fact, it may only be as far as the Coral Gables Biltmore Hotel.
We learn about one of South Florida's famously haunted places. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, some voters in South Florida might be left without full representation in state government during the next legislative session. There are three state legislative seats that are soon to be vacant. They're all held by Black Democrats from Broward and Palm Beach counties who resigned to run for Congress. After months of delays yesterday, Governor Ron DeSantis set special election dates to fill these seats, but it might be a little late, leaving South Florida not completely represented when lawmakers vote on laws in early 2022. Joining us now is the Sun Sentinel's political writer, Anthony Mann. Anthony, tell us about these legislative seats. Who's currently holding them?
Well, as you said, it's three state legislators, two veterans and one relatively new member of the legislature. And under the state's resigned to run law, Senator Perry Thurston from Broward and Representative Bobby DuBose, also from Broward, and Representative Omari Hardy from Palm Beach County, they had to submit irrevocable resignations in July so that they could qualify to become candidates for the congressional seat that is being filled shortly. That's the seat that became vacant with the death in April of Congressman Elsie Hastings. Now, so they had to submit these irrevocable resignations, and they represent districts that are not entirely, but largely minority districts. The biggest voting population blocks in each are Black voters. And the way the districts are drawn is whoever the next lawmakers are, they will almost certainly be Democrats. So these seats are about to become vacant in January, and we may have the entire next legislative session, in fact, almost certainly will not be represented in those three South Florida districts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, vacant beginning January, and they're going to remain that way for some time. Is that, have you ever seen that before?
Well, yes. It's with the current case of the vacancy created by Congressman Hastings' death. And it also involved Governor DeSantis' decision on delaying setting the special election. And the congressman died on April 6th, and the general election that will finally fill the seat isn't until January 11th. That's going to be more than 9 months that the seat will have been vacant, and that no one can remember any time in Florida, certainly not in recent decades, when that has happened. This is an unusually long time for the congressional seat to be kept open, and an unusually many, many, many more weeks and months for the state legislative seats.
Yeah, when are those going to be filled?
Well, the governor set the special primary elections for those three seats to be on January 11th, when at the same time as the general election for the congressional seat. But then he set the final general elections for the legislative seats for March 8th, when there already are a lot of local government elections scheduled in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Now, what the governor didn't do, and what many local election officials wanted him to do, and many South Florida political leaders wanted him to do, those vacancies became official and irrevocable at the end of July. They wanted him to quickly set special election dates so the special primaries for the legislative seats could be in November, in just a week, next week, along with the congressional primary, and then the general election could be in January. If that had happened, there would be new legislators who might miss just the beginning of the annual legislative session, but would serve the entire time.
And do we know why the governor...
That's not going to happen.
Well, you know, what did the governor say why he made that decision? Why those dates?
His office has consistently either not answered or not directly answered that question. So we don't have an explanation from them. The Harvard Election Law Clinic, which brought the suit, and then many Democrats throughout Broward and Palm Beach counties, say they can see no other reason than he wanted to keep the Democratic seats vacant. And it gives the Republicans who control the Senate and the House, Governor DeSantis's fellow Republicans, it gives them a little bit more of an edge in the annual legislative session.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, since they have both chambers, is it really that much more of an edge?
Well, they're getting very close to the point where Democrats won't even have a third of the members of the House and Senate. They're not there yet, but they're quite close and teetering on that on the edge of that. And so, in theory, if that happens, then the Republicans would have 2/3 and could essentially be unbridled in whatever policy agendas they wanted to pursue. Yeah,
there would be no challenge for them at all. You
right. know? As it stands now, the net effect and what you're getting at is the Republicans still have overwhelming control and can implement what they want to implement. But three fewer seats does make it a little bit harder for Democrats to eke out anything.
Right. Again, I'm talking with the Sun Sentinel's political writer, Anthony Mann, talking about the three soon to be vacant legislative seats, all held by Black Democrats from Broward and Palm Beach counties. Those special elections have been delayed even longer. And you can find a link to his reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to turn the conversation over now to talk about the upcoming local elections. Election Day is Tuesday for some of South Florida's biggest cities. Early voting already underway. And the numbers show voter turnout really, really low. We have a panel of local reporters joining us to talk about this. Again, I still have Anthony Mann. Lance Dixon is WLRN's digital editor. He joins us. And Samantha Gross, Miami Herald's local government reporter. Samantha, let me start with you. What was voter turnout or what has voter turnout looked like so far? Because first numbers I've seen really low.
Yeah, so far in terms of early voting and mail voting, it's pretty low. And so a lot of groups, you know, that are working on turnout and getting voters out to the polls early are, you know, really trying to do that work now. But I was able to kind of look back at past numbers and even in, you know, past years, these off-year elections, which are years where the president or the governor is not on the ballot, turnout is historically low in Miami-Dade.
Anthony, in Broward, in-person early voting has been so low that Supervisors of Elections Joe Scott cut the polling staff hours. Is that right?
Well, he didn't cut the length of time the early voting sites would be open. But yes, there were so many people staffing the early voting sites for so few voters that he reduced everybody's hours, essentially, to not have so much overlap. Most of early voting for a federal election operates under rules set up by the state. Broward and Palm Beach counties added just a little bit of time to that. But staffing up for that is a huge commitment. And so far, it has not gotten very much interest. A lot of people are voting by mail, but early voting for the first 3 days, it was about one voter. The polling sites averaged about one voter every 15 minutes.
Wow. Samantha, have you seen anything on the mail-in ballot so far?
Yeah. On Tuesday, which was a week before Election Day here in Miami-Dade, I took a look at some of the turnout numbers. And in Miami, Miami Beach, Homestead, Sunny Isles, Hialeah, turnout hasn't reached 10%. Definitely, you know, some people voting by mail, less people voting early, but, you know, still left to be seen. There's still time.
All right, Lance, we have to remember that, yes, it's next year is the governor's race. That's the big one. And then, of course, 2 years later, the presidential race. Not a lot of turnout for these, but there's some very important races. Let's remind people what's happening next week.
Yeah, I mean, so in Miami-Dade County, at least, there are multiple races that involve the mayors of some of our biggest cities, City of Miami, City of Hialeah. There's mayoral race in Miami Beach, in Sunny Isles Beach, in Homestead. And these are essentially, you know, they say that all politics is local, and these are the people who are running the show essentially in these various city halls. And so it is a bit of a disconnect there, that these really big positions and some key ballot items, there's a potential new city that could be incorporated in Miami-Dade County. And obviously, as you talked about with Anthony, the congressional district primary. So there's a lot of big stuff happening next Tuesday, and you know, just hope that folks would kind of grasp onto that, even though there isn't something big like a president or a governor on the ballot.
And, you know, the other big thing too, right, is the last call, the issue on Miami Beach is going to be up too as well.
Yeah.
Samantha, you wrote about this, and I thought this example was very telling. In Miami, Mayor Francis Suarez, he'll tout that he was elected in 2017 with 86% of the vote. But what did you find looking closer at the number? What was really there?
Right. So Mayor Suarez did win, you know, with a big number. But that year, only about 11.3% of voters in the city of Miami turned out. So it's a pretty small group of people to represent, you know, the electorate as a whole. And so in the story, we were able to kind of look at, you know, what types of people vote and who votes in these folks that do have a lot of power. You know, 11% isn't a lot of people, so it's not super representative of all the folks that live in the city of Miami.
11%. That's really low.
Yep. And, you know, turnout in Miami is not historically high either. So it was not a fluke, but it's something that we look at, you know, when we talk about folks who win, you know, winning an election is winning election, whether you have high turnout or low turnout, but it does matter, you know, who's casting those ballots.
Samantha, what do we know about who usually turns out for these kind of local elections?
Sure. So I took a look at the city of Miami 2017 as kind of an example, because that was the last time there was an off-year mayoral election. And the only six polling places in the city that had turnout over 20% were in Little Havana, West Flagler, Flagami, Coral Way area, where registered voters at those precincts were all overwhelmingly Republican and over the age of 66. So the dominant thread tends to be older voters. And, you know, it's something that, you know, we see in other cities, but the city of Miami was a good example of, you know, who turns out.
Samantha, are identity politics at play in elections like this, local elections?
Yeah. So experts that I talked to for this story kind of talked about identity politics and how they really matter, especially in local elections where there's not stark contrasts like political party that you would see in partisan races, perhaps in, you know, presidential year elections, governor election or gubernatorial elections. So when an election isn't partisan, voters do look for other cues like the last name on the ballot, and they're able to kind of divine, you know, what a candidate's race or ethnicity is, or what group that person represents, and kind of what power that person would give to the group that the voter belongs to, and you know, how it would best benefit them. So identity politics are surely at play, especially in off-year elections like the one that we're seeing here.
Anthony, I wanted to get the latest in that special primary to replace former Congresswoman Alcee Hastings. A lot of people vying for that seat.
Yes, and it really underscores something Samantha was just saying a moment ago. There are 11 candidates. Most people think they're about the kind of two tiers, about half are in the group most likely to win, and the other half don't really have a clear path to victory. But again, to underscore what Samantha was just saying, you could have a voter turnout in the Democratic primary, because this district is so overwhelmingly Democratic. Whoever wins the primary is virtually guaranteed to become the next member of Congress. You could have a voter turnout of 12%, but with so many candidates, somebody could win that with 15-18% of the primary vote, maybe just a few hundred votes separating the person from the second place finisher, and that person will again almost certainly win the general election. So very small pockets of voters are going to determine who's going to be in Congress from this district in Broward and Palm Beach.
Very low turnout. It's going to make that determination. And Lance, I mean, again, also low turnout determines local issues. I mean, again, I'm wondering, why is it that voters not realizing the impact that their mayor or some of these other things are going to have? Again, Miami Beach, they're going to be voting on this 2 a.m. thing. That's going to be massive.
Yeah. I think that a lot of what Samantha and Anthony have kind of been discussing and some of the reporting is bearing out is that I think that there's just not as much of a focus because people don't see those big names. And if there are big names or names that are familiar, folks kind of feel like they know them. So they just kind of gravitate to that. And then maybe they're not as familiar with some of the issues that the candidates are putting out there because they aren't necessarily at the same scale as what a president is deciding on, what a governor is deciding on, what multiple congresspeople are deciding on, and so forth. And I think that historically, just in these off years, it almost catches people off guard in some cases. And so until you really start seeing those mailers in your mailbox or maybe, you know, looking at a more digital kind of thing, those ads on your YouTube videos or what have you, you're not really thinking about these things. And then before you know it, early voting is about to end relatively soon. It's wrapping up this weekend, for example, across our region. And so if you haven't really educated yourself or paid as much attention as you might in some of these bigger years, and 2020 was just such a grueling thing beyond the pandemic. It was such a huge election. I think that there might even be a little bit of fatigue for voters. It's like, how do I kind of gear myself back up to care this much or be this invested about this thing when it doesn't have in maybe these voters' minds, the sort of stakes that a president
and
might have.
Remind folks, too, by the way, because if in case they're not sure, they're not following, like, what are the resources and, you know, what do they need to know about where they can early vote and so forth, we have that for them.
Yeah. It's all on WLRN.org right there on our homepage. And we have links to where you can find your sample ballot, where you can drop off your mail ballot if you'd like to, early voting locations, all that kind of stuff. So and the Supervisor of Elections websites in all of these counties also have that information as well. So it is there. It's just, I think, a matter of seeking it out and kind of finding the time to educate yourself.
I know it's not one of the big election years, but always remember we are voting for the people who represent us, whether on a local, state, or federal level, and all of them have an impact on our lives. Just something that we should never take for granted. I want to thank WLRN Digital Editor Lance Dixon, Miami Herald Local Government Reporter Samantha Gross, and Sun Sentinel's political writer Anthony Mann. Everyone, thank you so much for the insight. Well, still to come, a Republican strategist talks about Governor DeSantis' future and does not hold back her critiques. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Ron DeSantis was a slam dunk until he wasn't. That's the title of a recent New York Times op-ed written by Republican strategist Liz Mayer. DeSantis has been a controversial figure since he took office in 2019. Some Floridians and Democratic leaders remain upset with how he's handled the pandemic. From banning mandatory masks in schools to battling cruise lines, DeSantis has become a controversial leader. We know he's running for re-election to the governor's mansion in 2022, but there have been for some time rumblings that he could be running for the White House in 2024. We spoke with Liz last week about the governor's political future. It's obvious that Governor Ron DeSantis has gotten a lot of attention nationwide as a possible contender for the 2024 presidential nomination for the Republicans. Does he need to win the re-election, though, for governor in 2022 to have a chance?
Yeah, I think pretty clearly he does. I mean, ultimately, if he were to lose that re-election race, I think it would really diminish his standing. Also, potentially, it would elevate a Democrat who could then be a contender for, you know, their own 2024 nomination race. So, yes, he obviously does need to get through re-election first. And I think that's part of why you continually see that every time somebody asks him about his presidential ambitions or asks his team about his presidential ambitions, you know, they talk about how he's really focused on re-election, right? I mean, because ultimately he does have to win in order to stand a chance.
Where does his approval rating stand right now?
Well, so this is a little bit to be determined. We did have some polling that came out not that long before I published the piece that I published in the New York Times that showed that he had suffered a 12-point diminishment since, I guess it was when the poll was taken at a sort of similar time in 2019. So, you know, roughly a two-year period, he's knocked off 12 points. But from what I've seen, I don't think that the poll that I was looking at, which was Quinnipiac, I don't think that they've come out with more recent numbers. And that's the question, right? Because in some regards, people think that, you know, a lot of these governors in states who have been more resistant to, you know, allowing local areas to do or private businesses to do vaccine mandates or mask mandates or what have you, you know, that as COVID has kind of receded and as the Delta wave has passed through, they're going to see their numbers rise again. And that may well be true, but I just don't think that we have a lot of data to show that where we're actually comparing apples to oranges. There are other polls that have come out, obviously, since I published the piece, and they do, you know, indicate various things about his popularity, but there's nothing that's really like for us to be able to compare the same type of poll, the same methodology, et cetera, et cetera. So it looks like he's taken a bit of a hit. The question is that going to endure? And I don't think anybody necessarily knows the answer to that.
And so, I mean, so that leads to the question, you know, how should we be looking at approval ratings if there's still a lot of time before the election anyway?
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I don't think that anybody should probably be taking any numbers that they see right now for granted. And I think smart candidates generally don't, right? They recognize that, you know, the saying is the only poll that matters is the one that's actually taken on election day when people go and vote. And that is largely the case, right? But I think at the same time, you know, clearly, when you sort of stand back and you look at the numbers that you saw in that Quinnipiac poll versus where they had been previously for him, it kind of gives some hints as to why he may have been doing some of the things that he was doing. And I think that there are, you know, sort of some breadcrumbs, I guess I would say, that indicate that for as much as he seems to have pursued this very, you know, red meat base type strategy where you're looking at COVID response, there are also some indicators that not all Republicans in Florida were necessarily happy with that. And so, you know, there's some stuff that you sort of sense that he's doing to try to shore up his numbers with his own base.
And you know,
I think it's clear that he doesn't feel that he's in as strong a position as he did, you know, maybe a couple of months ago. And we'll see the next time Quinnipiac actually tests all of this with regard to him, where his numbers come out. But it would seem based on sort of his own actions that, you know, he's cognizant of the fact that Florida has moved in a red direction pretty starkly, but it's not Ohio and it's not Iowa.
And you know, talking about COVID, I mean, we don't know what the pandemic's going to be over the next year, but we know what it's been. And yeah. I'm wondering how his handling of COVID is going to play out.
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I mean, I think in general, we can look and see that, you know, Donald Trump's handling of COVID, it was one of the things that was decisive in his defeat at the presidential level, right? And I think part of the reason that it was is pretty clearly because seniors who were more affected by COVID and more adversely affected by COVID were not happy with his handling of it, and they were worried. And so usually senior voters tend to be a bit more conservative. But when you were looking at the 2020 election, you know, they were looking more friendly to Democrats than what they typically do. So that's a question, because Florida obviously does have a lot of older voters in it. But Florida also has a lot of people who migrate back and forth and aren't necessarily registered to vote there and aren't necessarily part of the electorate. And so, you know, there are all sorts of sort of uncertainties here. I also think another thing that's a question is, as somebody who calls Connecticut home, I mean, I've seen a lot of people from Connecticut and New York actually move down to Florida in the course of the pandemic, you know, sort of looking at looser restrictions, arguably better tax business climate, literally better climate when you're looking at the winter months, right?
Right.
And one of the questions that I have is that while a lot of those people have been attracted by taxes and the business climate, which tends to be something that's more associated with Republicans, I do sort of wonder if those people migrating the same way as you've seen, you know, Texas and Colorado and other places move more blue, as you've had Californians migrating to them, even though those are people who are fed up with, you know, some of the policies that you see in extremely blue states, they still have moved to other states and taken those states in a bluer direction. And so I just don't know to what extent you're going to see those people having moved, re-registered, and how that ends up affecting the whole political situation and dynamic in Florida. And I don't think that DeSantis team really has a firm handle on that right now either, to be honest with you.
I'm speaking with Liz Mayer. She's a Republican strategist who's worked for campaigns by U.S. Senator Rand Paul and former Governor of Texas Rick Perry. She recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about Governor Ron DeSantis' chances of becoming a contender for the 2024 presidential election. But first, he has to win Florida in 2022. You can find a link to that piece on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, coming back to what you said, though, you know, going all in on the red meat, you know, he's pushed hard on the conservative side. And we saw it with the anti-riot law, the vaccine passport ban, critical race theory, even picking the fight with the cruise industry. You know, wondering what his strategy is. Is it let's go ahead and fire up the base? Is that going to work, though, in the reelection next year? Doesn't he have to move a little center to try to win back some people, win over some people?
Yeah, so that's the question. I mean, I think the cruise stuff is particularly interesting. And full disclosure, my firm has done some consulting for cruise lines, not particularly recently, and not anything that pertains to this. But, you know, as somebody who has done some work with the cruise industry, and also as somebody who has taken cruises in her lifetime, I do think that kind of picking the fight there was interesting because, you know, people who take cruises kind of are the core demographic that you would expect Republicans to want to attract, right, and to have attracted. So, yeah, you know, you've got data that shows that for the first time ever, Republican registrations in Florida, you know, may actually be sort of starting to equalize out with Democratic registrations. That's a difference. And it suggests that by doing a lot of red meat stuff, you know, he may have more base voters and he may be in a position to do a little better by operating with this base voter strategy. But I guess my question again, and we just don't have an answer to this right now, is who are those Republicans? Who's doing the re-registering? Because if it's people who were drawn to Trump and are very Trumpy, then I think a lot of the kind of stuff that he's doing probably works really well. But if they are people who, you know, maybe we're registered Republicans in a state like Connecticut, so they've moved and they've re-registered and they've registered as Republicans in Florida, I don't think those kinds of people are necessarily Trumpy kinds of people at all. I think they're the kind of people who probably are more concerned about tax rates. They're probably more interested in sort of Florida traditions when it comes to sort of education reform and things like that. I also think, you know, when he first ran, one of the things that was kind of interesting was he sort of went and did pick this fight with the sugar industry, right? So you had sort of this strange segment that I don't think accounts for much in the electorate, but it is a little bit in Florida that are sort of these libertarians who also align on some environmental issues. And I don't know exactly where those people fit into it. What I will say is that we know from the Trump experiment that in 2016, it seems weird now to look back and talk about Trump in 2016 as having been a more moderate candidate, but he really was, right? I mean, this is a guy who was more economically moderate generally. What you heard from him in debates, it didn't sound like, you know, Club for Growth, Ted Cruz type stuff. And then on social issues, I mean, yes, he came out and said he was pro-life, but most people suspected that he wasn't really that pro-life. And, you know, he'd been like fairly gay friendly, generally LGBTQ plus friendly, you know, and people remember that he did this sketch with Rudy Giuliani in drag where he like motorboated Rudy Giuliani and whatever. Like, people just didn't see Donald Trump in 2016 as being this arch conservative guy. But by the time he got to 2020, he was seen as having moved in a pretty starkly conservative direction. And there is data that shows that that did cost him a lot of votes. And so that's, I think that's the question, is when you look at the way that these things have tended to go nationally, it looks like what DeSantis is doing is pretty risky. But there is also some data in Florida that suggests that it might be smart strategy. And we just don't really know.
And the part of this, too, is we don't know is what role Trump will play in the election. He now does
Correct.
Live in Florida part of the year, and they were very close.
Yes, and they also, the DeSantis team has exhibited some caution about Trump, right? I mean, when you had the disaster happen with the building collapse, and then you had Trump wanting to do a rally, he wasn't even particularly close to there. If I recall, it was like a couple hours drive. But DeSantis was really concerned about Trump going out there and doing something, just concerned generally about looking insensitive to sort of the grief that people were going through and the emotions that people were going through. So, you know, they obviously are attuned to the fact that Trump is a big factor in all of this. And that's the thing. I mean, we haven't really been thinking about how that factors into all of this, because actually Trump has been relatively quiet. You know, he puts out his statements and his missives, and obviously he's been doing things with, you know, I think today, like, he's been doing his launch of his new media property, right, what have you.
Yeah.
It's not like he's been conducting himself doing these like massive daily rallies, like what we remember from years previous, and like he probably will do more of as we head to 2022. So it's just really hard to kind of say where this is all going to land. But I think the bottom line from where I sit and what I see is, you know, if we go back a couple of months, I feel like everybody I knew who was a political prognosticator and really assessed the numbers and dived deeper into them than what I do was saying that there was basically no way that Ron DeSantis could lose re-election. And now we see some numbers that suggest that he could lose re-election. That doesn't mean he's likely to, or that it's a sure bet, or even that if you are somebody who likes to gamble, you should be going and putting even $5 on the possibility. But his re-election looks like less of a sure thing than it did.
And what about
fairly recently?
What about, because earlier you talked about, you know, the Republicans are edging closer to the Democrats and registered voters, but we also see, you know, the no party affiliation group is growing. You know, how do they play out in this?
Yeah, again, that's the question, is everybody has to figure out what type of no party affiliation voter are they? Because, you know, classically you have people who tend to affiliate as independents who are, you know, economically maybe a little bit more conservative, socially a little bit more liberal, could go for either party, could be swing voters. Overall, I think in the American political system as a whole, we're seeing fewer true swing voters, right? You're seeing more polarization, and maybe a lot of people who call themselves independents or don't declare a party preference, but in practice, they do routinely vote for one or the other. So, you know, are we talking about that sort of classic independent who is probably a more moderate voter, or are we talking about people who just sort of hate political parties but actually do have a pretty defined philosophy that stacks up with one or the other? And I just don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. And I think some of this, you know, I think people moving around because of COVID, I think that's going to affect it. But my suspicion is in Florida, yeah, probably a lot of those people are fairly moderate individuals, and I think they're not necessarily going to be sold on what DeSantis has done. But again, some of his problem there isn't necessarily with independents or people who are would-be swing voters. You look at some of the red counties and how they've responded to things he, you know, sort of diktats he has issued with regard to masks in schools. Yeah, and it's not entirely, you know, woke progressive liberals or independents or suburban moms who used to vote Republican but bailed and started voting for Joe Biden or whatever. Some of this is people in pretty deep red counties who are pretty hard and fast Republicans who just aren't lined up with him on some of these COVID measures. So it's going to be a very interesting race to watch.
Let me finish with this. I don't know if he learns anything from Trump or if he needs to, looking back on the 2020 election, but getting ready for next year, what's going to be the issue? Because the economy seems good. We're not, COVID numbers are down. Everything seems okay. What's going to be the issue to carry on?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when we thought COVID was going in a totally fine direction until the Delta variant popped up, right? So I don't think we're really at a place where we can necessarily preclude the possibility of another variant popping up and that becoming an issue. It could be something like that. That's always a possibility. But I would also say, you know, we're having a big debate nationally between the parties over what's going on with inflation. The Biden team seems convinced that this is transitory, and Republicans are very convinced that it's not. What I will say is, if it turns out that inflation is not transitory, and my suspicion is that actually it might be here to stay for quite a bit longer, I think, than Democrats are hoping, that's something that could be a real issue, and that could accrue very well to DeSantis's favor, because obviously people who tend to be hit really hard by inflation are people with fixed living costs, i.e. senior citizens, which is not the whole of Florida, obviously, but there's a pretty substantial chunk there compared to a lot of other states. So, I mean, if I were Democrats right now, I'd be really concerned about watching what's going on with inflation and whether that's something that can be brought under control. And if I were a Republican running for office, that's something I'd be pretty keen to exploit.
And again, that's my conversation with a Republican strategist and consultant, Liz Mayer. You can read her New York Times op-ed piece. Just visit our social media at WLRN Sundial. And don't forget about our Sundial Text Club. It's the easiest way to stay in touch with us and also to connect with us if you have ideas or questions, or maybe you think there's a topic we should be discussing. You could share it with us in the Text Club. If you want to join, it's really easy. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Well, still to come, the Miami Dolphins are struggling, and they're trying to change that with a controversial trade. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Miami Dolphins came into the season with a lot of hope for success, and instead, they're one of the worst teams in the league. They have one win. For the last few weeks, there have been rumors that they may try and make a trade with the Houston Texans for quarterback Deshaun Watson. Except, here's the thing. Watson is facing 20 civil lawsuits of sexual harassment and misconduct. Some people believe that he could help Miami turn things around. But how do the players and coaches feel about all of those allegations that Watson is facing? What are the ethics around professional players with controversial legal baggage? I spoke with Daniel Oyefusi. He's the Dolphins beat reporter for the Miami Herald. And we started with, what exactly are the Dolphins thinking about right now?
The Dolphins remain interested in a trade for Deshaun Watson, who, as we all know, hasn't played this season as he is, you know, kind of clouded by these close to 24 civil suits involving allegations of sexual harassment or misconduct during massage appointments. You know, based on conflicting reports and where you're looking at your news, you know, there have been reports from Houston Chronicle that the Dolphins have actually agreed to the compensation in a trade for Deshaun Watson, but Stephen Ross is waiting for Deshaun Watson to kind of clear up all those legal situations before he completely greenlights the deal. Other reports have said that the Dolphins have yet to, you know, fully come up to the Texans' asking price. So again, we're kind of in a wait and see mode. I've been calling it Watson watch for the past couple of weeks or so. You know, if a deal is going to get made, it has to be made in these next couple of days. So we're all going to be watching to see what happens.
You know, this is, I guess, the challenge when you think about professional sports and the pressure to win. But, what have you heard from players and coaches about Deshaun Watson's situation? Over 20 allegations of sexual harassment, assault, and misconduct. I mean, do they put winning above, a man's, I guess, character?
Yeah, that's the real question in all of this. Really, you know, we've seen in the NFL players who have done really bad things serve their time or, let the legal process play out and then come back to their teams or different teams and keep on playing. And the question is really, you know, at what point is, you know, this too much? Even if he is able to maybe get past some of these allegations or settles or whatever the process may be, it's like, would you still feel comfortable with this guy, particularly this quarterback, being the face of your franchise? And I think that if they do make a move for Deshaun Watson, those are questions that from top to bottom, whether it's Stephen Ross, Chris Greer, Brian Flores, all of them will have to answer those tough questions.
The ownership of the Dolphins, they want to see, you know, some kind of closure on this, on the issue, the legal issues that Deshaun Watson's facing. What exactly is it they want to see?
I think that they would, whether it's some type of settlement or just some resolution in the criminal and the civil process. There have been reports that Deshaun Watson has not wanted to settle because that'd be an admission of guilt. There's been some, you know, back and forth over whether there would be NDAs with the settlement. So I think that from Stephen Ross and the Miami front, they just want it to all go away. They want it to be cleared, and they want some type of idea of how long he would be suspended so they can kind of prepare and plan for that. But you know, this whole legal process has been in a state of limbo for really months since the first, you know, allegations and suits started to come out in the springtime. So, I mean, for them to think that there might be some resolution by next Tuesday's trade deadline, I think that's not realistic at all.
And what is going to happen to Tua Tagovailoa, the quarterback for the Dolphins?
Well, obviously, if you're bringing in Deshaun Watson, that would kind of end the Tua Tagovailoa era, experiment, whatever you want to call it, in Miami. And that's part of the reason why I'm kind of skeptical of whether a deal will really unfold or kind of come to fruition in the next couple of days. You know, I would think that if they're trading for Deshaun Watson, they're kind of told us what direction they're going with this franchise, and that would mean that they would have to kind of move Tua off the roster. You know, it'd be a really awkward situation for everyone involved to have both those quarterbacks. So, you know, they're kind of doing double duty. You know, they're trying to trade for Deshaun Watson, and I would think that if they're trying to do that, they're also trying to get rid of Tua. And, you know, there haven't really been a lot of reports or inklings that, you know, there's a big market for him for whatever reason that may be.
Why is a team willing to give up on a guy that, you know, again, everything was let's tank for Tua, let's play terribly so that we get a first round pick and get this guy. We wanted him so badly. He's only played 13 games. He's actually played decently. And, you know, anybody who looks at statistics, which is what sports is all about, there are a lot of Hall of Fame quarterbacks that didn't have, you know, a great start, you know, as good as Tua's. Why are they giving up so fast?
No, it's a really good question. And he has played well, especially in these past two games since returning from fractured ribs. You know, someone asked me this, you know, really months ago before the talks really started heating up. And I kind of made an analogy, you know, draft picks and especially first round picks are kind of like cars, you know, when you're looking at them and kind of window shopping or whatever, they look so valuable. And as soon as you drive it off the lot, the value just completely plummets. And, you know, that's no fault of the cars or the players, but that's just how it is. And with Tua, I think there are some fair questions about, you know, his NFL longevity, whether he can, you know, kind of hold up for 16 or now 17 games. I think there are questions about maybe his arm strength and his ability to be a top flight quarterback. So in that aspect, you can kind of understand the Dolphins, you know, putting the legal situation aside, you can kind of understand they're wanting to get a top five or top 10 quarterback in the room and kind of build around that, you know.
You know, you get to see the team in practice, and I'm wondering, this. I mean, look, when the season started, there were expectations that maybe this team could be a playoff team, and maybe Tua was the future. And now all of a sudden the team's losing and the chances of making the playoffs are very slim. What's the feel, you know, out there on the field with the players? How do they feel about what's going on?
Well, I think there's widespread disappointment throughout, you know, the walls of their practice facility. You know, like you said, this was a team that was expected to take another step coming off a 10-win season. They're expected to at least contend for a playoff spot again, and they have fallen really short of that. But through it all, when talking to players, you hear the same thing. You know, there's a good pop. That's what Byron Jones told us on Wednesday. He said there's a good pop, there's some urgency. You know, guys are disappointed, but they're not pointing fingers, they're not getting negative. And I think that's a good, you know, mindset to have, a good way to approach things. You know, no one has liked the way the season has unfolded, but, you know, getting angry and getting upset isn't going to make things better. So I think that there's an urgency, but they also are keeping spirits high.
But how do they feel about Tua? And how do they feel about all these rumors of getting Deshaun Watson? Because that's got to be really awkward.
You know, when talking to his teammates, I think that there is a lot of support for him. You know, Matt Collins, you know, that's his guy. You know, he's like, Tua's that dude. Tua's my guy. When talking to Mike Gesicki and others, you can tell that he has support in that building. You know, obviously I haven't pulled every single player, so I can't necessarily, you know, vouch for or speak for every single player. But it is a tough position for him. I think it kind of stems back to his rookie season and being inserted over Ryan Fitzpatrick. And Ryan Fitzpatrick really had a great relationship with the guys he met in that locker room. Those guys really rallied around him early on in the season. And, you know, obviously Tua is his own type of leader, but it's kind of tough knowing that they had Ryan Fitzpatrick and he was a real rah-rah guy, got gravitated to him. And he's not necessarily that type of leader. So it is kind of tough trying to really take control of this leader, take control of this locker room and be his own leader in his own right as a young player.
And again, that was Daniel Oyefusi. He's the Dolphins beat reporter for the Miami Herald. You could read more of his reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Miami plays Buffalo, the number one team in the division, this weekend. Well, it's Halloween season, and that means that it's that time to think about ghosts and ghouls and frightening stories. And you have to admit, many of the best stories are the ones that are linked to real people and places. And South Florida has a lot of great places that have haunted histories, and one of them is in Coral Gables. It's the Biltmore Hotel. Let's go back to a story from 2014. This is from Julia Duba, a story about the haunted stories that we've enjoyed over the years about the famous hotel.
Do you believe in ghosts? Spirits from beyond?
In the early 1970s, the Biltmore Hotel was an abandoned shell. And it was creepy.
The supernatural world may not be as far as you think. In fact, it may only be as far as the Coral Gables Biltmore Hotel.
This audio is from the late 80s, from a documentary about the legends and the ghosts of the Biltmore. The hotel's abandoned years were crucial to its haunted reputation.
All the kids would always talk about, oh, there must be ghosts in there.
Betsy Skip grew up in Coral Gables and used to sneak into the Biltmore with her friends. Local kids like Skip knew some of the Biltmore's history, the glamour of the 20s and 30s, how it became a World War II hospital, how people died there. In 1952, the old hotel became the temporary home to the University of Miami Medical School. When UM opened its own medical school, the Biltmore was left empty. That's when kids started sneaking in.
Going in there and being wickedly scared and what we would find, and then having to run out because of creaking noises.
In 1973, the city of Coral Gables took the building over. So many local kids were breaking into the abandoned hotel that the city decided to hire a security guard. Kim Dunzucco says they used to call the guard the Greenie for the green golf cart he would drive around the massive building. She says sneaking past the Greenie was part of the fun.
But once you got in, that's when it started to get a little creepy and quiet and creaking. And then you started thinking about, oh, it was a hospital. And, well, in a hospital, there's morgues.
She said one time a friend swore he saw a severed limb in the Biltmore.
The dead body factor was the most terrifying for us. I remember we just ripped it out of there.
In 1983, Coral Gables put $55 million into restoring the Biltmore. 10 years later, the hotel was added to the National Registry of Historic Places. The building may have been restored to glory, but the ghost stories didn't stop.
I heard story after story.
Starting in 1994, Linda Spitzer told ghost stories in the Biltmore's lobby. She was a staple for 10 years before she moved to Lake Worth.
The guests loved it. I would tell them, you know, I'm here from 7 to 7:30. It dragged on till 8.
In the 1920s, the Miami Biltmore Hotel, as it was called, hosted fashion shows, galas, golf tournaments, and water shows in what was then the largest pool in the world. Spitzer would tell guests how, in 1929, a famous gangster named Thomas Fatty Walsh was shot on the 13th floor of the hotel during a party. That story yielded lots of ghost rumors over the years. Guests told Spitzer they'd hear things. Things that sounded like the party Fatty Walsh was shot at.
Somebody will call down and say, there's a loud band playing upstairs. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And the receptionist would say, there's nobody in that room. How do you explain that?
The building that used to terrify Coral Gables children is now an icon, one with a celebrity guest list that reportedly includes Bill Clinton, Robert Redford, and Johnny Depp. It's far from the creepy place Kim Dunzucco used to sneak into. But as an adult, Zucco says the place was, and still is, inescapable.
It's such a beautiful building with so much history and so much mystery that you can't help but be drawn to it, whether it's empty or living and breathing right now.
And that was the story from former WLRN reporter Julia Duba. You can find a link to it on our social media at WLRN. Sundial, and I'd love to hear from you. What is your favorite haunted place in South Florida? Maybe you've been there and you've seen something. Share it with us. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial at WLRNnews.org. I still haven't seen anything at the Biltmore, but it's not to say I am still trying. That's our program for this Thursday, October 28th. Coming up next week on the program, we will be joined by Palm Beach County Schools' new permanent superintendent. The district's former chief finance officer, Mike Burke, has been filling the role as interim for the past few months. Board members have put their full confidence in him and have abandoned plans for a national search. If you've got a question for the superintendent, email it to us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Plus, a new exhibit honoring a local politician who spent the last 50 years in public service. Former Miami-Dade Commissioner Barbara Jordan joins us to talk about her long political career and the importance of being civically engaged. And that's our program for today. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll be back live on Monday. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.